Okay, we're back on after a break. And while we were off of the recording, we were chatting a little bit, and it came up that you were talking about access to women's restrooms throughout your career. So I was wondering if you could share a little bit about your experience with that.
Well, when you're the only woman around, you really don't want to have to use the men's facilities. And you don't want them using your facilities. So when I went offshore, they had to have a special restroom set aside for me. Another funny restroom story, when I went to Rice, the chemistry building was built with no restrooms at all. And so they converted an entire big classroom. They had big classrooms in that building when it was built. And so it was a three-story building. So the first and third floor were the men's restroom, and the second floor was the women's restroom. I mean, it was big. It had a whole huge lounge like my living area here with couches and everything, and then the stalls and all were in a little separate facility. And that's where we went to change into our blue jeans before we went to our labs. So that was my first experience with bathrooms for women and how different they were. When I went to work at Shell, I don't recall exactly, but I think what we had was the way the engineering group was designed to work there, that in the pilot plant, we did not have a restroom for women. I think there was one for men. But when I needed to use the restroom, I had to go across the street into the main building of the research group to find the women's restroom, because they did have women in that building in a clerical capacity. As I don't remember whether they had any elsewhere in the refinery as I wandered around. I guess I didn't need to use it or knew what not to do. It was, I just don't remember.
Mm-hmm. Like the offshore example, did they do that knowing you were coming, or did you make
some— Oh, they knew I was coming.
So they took care of that beforehand.
Oh, before I came, yes. Mm-hmm. And when I went to the other offshore facilities, the other platforms, those were older platforms. Maybe they set one aside for my use during the day or something. I like I say, on most occasions I was off just for a matter of the few hours that were necessary to do whatever we needed to do on those offshore locations. It's funny, I don't remember the details of it, but there's so many different things that happen, it's hard to know.
Did you have to wear coveralls offshore? Was that fireproof clothing, special PPE?
No, there were no special. I didn't. In fact, my pictures, I made my a jumpsuit to wear for my startup. I actually sewed it myself. You couldn't find really good clothing for women. And I had to buy, it seems to me, for the startup, on the offshore platform, I did buy some sort of special shoe to wear. A safety shoe. I think I bought safety shoes for that project. No, but again, it's been a long time and I don't remember the details. I know I did have a hard hat working for Hudson, and I took it when I went to startups. I wore my own hard hat. But I don't recall having one working at the university.
And so you were talking about, you know, leaving Hudson in your retirement. So I'm wondering if you can talk now about, I know you did some work as a consultant after that. So one thing that I saw listed amongst your consulting work was that you served as an expert witness. And I was really curious what that role was like.
There's a really funny story connected with that one. No, I didn't do very much consulting work. I did not actively seek consulting work.
Okay.
I did a small project for GPSA. I did this expert witness thing. It was really hilarious because I went to give the deposition at a building in the Galleria section of Houston, and I walked in and the men were talking about seeing the cat on the top of the Transco Tower. And we have a building, very tall building there, and the top of it It just happens the way the angles are cut. If the light is coming at it and you're looking at it from any of the four corners, it looks like a cat with its tail sticking up the back, like my black cat Stop over there, sitting up with his ears pointing on the top and his tail coming up the back. And I had never seen it before. So that was the first thing we talked about. Okay, that's nice. Well, then we start the deposition, and they ask me, you know, who I am, and, you know, qualifications. And the guy, the trying to discredit me, you know, asked me, you know, are you married? Yes. And you have children? Yes. I said, are you married? Do you have children? Asked the question right back to him. To let it be known from the deposition that I knew it was not an appropriate question. He was trying to find my qualifications, and that didn't have a thing to do with my qualifications. And I made sure that went into the record. And that's the thing I remember about doing that particular deposition. I later did a pro bono consulting job, and we went to California and again had a deposition type arrangement and all. And it did not happen at that deposition at all.
And so how are you using your scientific and engineering knowledge to, you know, in that deposition? What kinds of things were you doing?
What was it? I can't even remember what the exact problem was on the first one.
Mm-hmm.
On the second one, I remember very vividly it was a matter of a way of doing process. And frankly, I thought that the guy that was suing for recognition did not reserve recognition. And I tried to tell him that, but he wouldn't listen. And insisted that, no, you know, we needed to do this. And, you know, he paid my way for me to go out there and I testified as to what I knew about it, but I did not come out and say, no, he did not deserve it. It was a new way of doing this particular part of processing. And again, I don't remember the precise details, but was it patentable? I don't know. I'm not a patent law attorney. It was a new idea. Is every new idea worthy of a patent? It's not. You're saying no. Well, it's difficult. But I testified as to what I saw and what I knew, and I told him what I would do, and I did it. But I had a very interesting experience in those days. When I retired, I signed up with something out of New York. Of retired, they call it retired technical executives or something, and you serve as technical advisors in third world countries when they have particular things. And they had an application for somebody to come help them with a type of gas processing in Morocco. And I was pretty well recognized as an authority in that field at that time. And so they offered my services. And when they found out I was a woman, the Moroccans decided they didn't want me. So this free service never supplied them with anybody.
Hmm.
So, and I've never been to Morocco since before, and I'm not going now. Mark them off my list. I did my last bit. See, we're in the book. Must be about 2001 is the last time I did anything like that. And my engineering today consists of working with my daughter at the Houston Community College, where I speak to this. I've always been interested in career guidance and been very active in various aspects of it, and I consider that part of that work.
Yeah.
I still think of myself as an engineer.
Mm-hmm. And I know you're saying you do this pro bono judging for the engineering class. Are there any projects that you've seen that really stand out to you, or students you've worked with there?
Over the years, there have been... Okay, the judging takes place at the end of each semester and the summer session, so it's three times a year or four times a year if they have two summer sessions. And I do not only her classes, but other classes. Depends on what my personal schedule is, and transportation has to be arranged and all that sort of thing. And the students and their assignments differ from what they, sometimes they get to pick what they're doing, sometimes they're told what to do and all. But in all the years of doing this thing, there have been about three occasions where they have come up with an idea or an act that I have thought was worthy of considering for patents, and have advised them that they need to go on. It's amazing what talents you can find in these totally new minds, new blank minds that have opened to thinking. And I put it to the stimulus of where my daughter is the professor and the other instructors that are participating with these students, that they are inspiring them to open up their minds and to let them think and to do things.
And I know something else you're involved in is the Rice University Engineering Alumni Organization. So I was wondering if you talk a little bit about what that organization does. And you served as director at one point, so if you could talk about also
that. Oh, that was a long time ago. I was when I was more active. All Rice Engineering alumni are automatically a, quote, member, whether you're an active member or not, depends on whether you do. So there's a lot of them. It's mainly an organization, you know, to promote engineers. And specifically, they work with the students that are there on campus and work at getting scholarship money for them, as now evolved. Supporting them in various ways. I guess originally it was to help probably finding jobs for them. But back when I was a director, it was so long ago, I can't even remember what we did. But we did encourage the students. And I know now we have an awards banquet. There are sufficient scholarships set up that are awarded that they... it's not a banquet, it's a barbecue thing, you know, outside type of, or something like that in the springtime. And so I did go to those, but I mean, I'm now to the point where I do not drive on the freeway, and I cannot drive after dark. My optometrist has advised that my eyesight is getting too bad, that it's better for me not to. I stopped driving on the freeway about 5 years ago when I realized that my reaction time was getting to the point that I did not feel it was safe for me to continue being a driver in those conditions, and so I quit. And it's just better to recognize your limitations and live with them. But the Engineering Society, it provides scholarships, and they have they've got another program now. They work with the students on career design objective. They've got a lot of mentoring type activities going on with the students. I'll put it that way. I'm not real familiar with all the details. Mm-hmm. One can't keep up with all. I know one thing that they do have on the Rice campus now is the engineering design kitchen that was started, and everybody, including the academic students, participate in those activities. And they have done some fantastic things. I don't see how the kids have time, frankly. But some of the things that they have done that has really impressed me has been some of the medical things. And a centrifuge, for instance, is needed for certain things. And somebody observed, I guess it was one of the women, that the salad makers, if you have a commercial kitchen and you put your lettuce in and you put it in and whirl it around by hand to get the water off of the lettuce before you make your salads with it. And they took this idea and adopted it to making it so that you could have a small spinning-like thing that you could spin that would do the centrifuge action and whatever is needed in blood analysis, whatever it is. And they developed, this was many years ago, that whatever that particular group of students did, developed all of the things that you need for a medical lab examination to fit into a backpack. This was to reach people like up in the Andes, in the mountains, where you go and you try to bring medical care. And then another group that has had a lot of publicity, under Dr., she's got a very fancy name, two, you know, a known name and another name after it, and they both have six syllables on them or something. And they have developed a very inexpensive incubator, because a lot of the babies in Africa were dying because they didn't have incubators for the newborns, which they only needed the little bit of help to make that immediate transition after birth. And they've saved a lot of lives that way. And they've done all sorts of other things. It was just, to me, fascinating. Oh, they did something for baseball, where that they could measure how fast the ball was going. And so for the baseball people, it's very important to know how fast. And apparently they've got that, where they developed the machinery to do that. It's amazing, truly amazing. I think there's still a lot of stuff to be discovered and done. I mean, that's where we need to spend our time.
And through the alumni organization or otherwise, have you stayed in touch with other Rice alumni? Have you ever reconnected with somebody either through the organization?
Well, Rice promotes alumni get-togethers, especially on the five-year basis thing. And I never did participate in anything until I was going to my 25th one, and it happened. Instead, that happened to be right at the time that I was offshore with my South Pass project, so I didn't get to go to that one. And when it came to be my 50th, I was going to go to that and was doing part of the programming and everything. And my daughter had a very difficult time in her marriage in New Jersey, and instead I had to go to New Jersey and be with her. But for 55, I went to the 55th anniversary. And lo and behold, let's see, there were about six of us engineers that were there, I guess, and then there were maybe 10 other women. And I got to see some of my fellow engineers that I hadn't seen in a long time. But now there's not very many. My very closest friends are Rice graduates, of course, and I've seen them through the years. And that was a group of about, let's see, there was George. Oh, about 10 of us. And we used to, this was back when our kids were growing up and all, and we would go out to dinner together and everything, and have kept track over the years with them. Mm-hmm. But now there's not very many of us left. Mm-hmm. I did go, after you hit the golden 50, they have and I went to the 55, so after that then, every year they have at homecoming, they have a luncheon for 50 years and all those that are beyond the 50-year mark. Mm-hmm. And I went to that one year with my friend Jackie. And, you know, I knew a few of the people that were there. There were some people that were actually older than us that I knew. And so, yeah, I keep in touch as much as you can. You can't keep in touch with everybody. But there's not very many left now at my age.
And I also want to note that you were awarded the Outstanding Engineering Alumna from Rice University in 1998.
That's correct.
And was there any ceremony involved in that award?
Yes. At that time, that was the only outstanding award that they gave, was the one. And I gave a talk. They have a convocation at the alumni. The fall reunion time, you know, the university, and they have this at the same time. And I gave a talk, and it was well attended, on what had happened in my career. And a picture in my hallway that I think I showed y'all of all of my grandchildren lined up in the stairway, that was taken at that talk. Mm. They were all there. And I had one of my grandsons with me, and as part of it, I got two tickets to the football game to sit in the super special box that they have for all the ex-football players, this place of honor. And what happened? Was that the one where the guy caught it and ran, caught the opposing team threw the ball and our guy caught it and ran, you know, 99 yards down to the other end? And it was a really bitterly cold day, and we got to see that play. It was very exciting that year. It was fun. Nowadays, they have two awards that they give, the Outstanding Engineering and the Outstanding Young Engineer.
Mm.
And I've gone to a number of those ceremonies. We've had some very outstanding people. Some of the developers of the computer people, some of them are really outstanding. And different ones. It's been interesting to go to.
Mm-hmm. So another thing you mentioned earlier was your service to the National Science Foundation in reviewing, you know, serving on different kinds of boards of review.
Right.
And so I think you might have mentioned the Presidential Young Investigator Award program. I was wondering if you talk a little bit more about what that program was and why you decided to be involved in that program.
Well, because they asked me. The Presidential Young Investigators program was started to help young professors starting out in their first, second, third year when they don't have any support, and to provide seed money to begin their research. It was a really good program, and I don't know who thought about it in the government. Somebody did, maybe one of the presidents. And so the young technical professors put in their bid to try to get it, and then they have a panel of people like me go over it and try to decide which are the best ideas to try to pursue, because you know, they may have enough. I don't know the precise numbers now or what they were then, but they might have enough awards to give 30 awards, and they might have 60 applicants, sort of thing. It's not as hard as it is, I'm sure, nowadays on the applications for universities, where they have one position and they have, like Rice might have 5,000 openings and they might have 65,000 applicants for that. It's not 6-for-1, it's more like 1 or 2 or 1.5. So you could mostly, you know, but you, it was interesting work, because you're looking at whatever is at that stage of development, what we're at. Supporting research is something that our government does need to do, and we need, I think it's a good use of our tax money, and it's not just in our, we also have in our government program, I know because of my daughters in music, they have a large support, and I've forgotten what that's called, that promotes the musicians going out and giving programs to the elementary school students so that they have and so that they can see things. And my daughter participated in some of those activities when she was playing the bassoon professionally. But I think it's a good use of our tax money.
And then you also served as on the advisory committee to the Chemical, Biochemical, and Thermal Division through the National Science Foundation. I was wondering if...
I did? If they say so, I guess that's what I guess that was what I was doing that PYI investigation for.
I
did not know. I was... Where did you find that in the record someplace?
It was saying... Yeah, I was saying that the PYI program was 1984 when you were reviewing for that, and that in 1985 you served on this advisory committee.
I guess so.
Okay. I was just wondering if you had any memories from that.
No.
Okay.
Whatever they asked me to do. That must be the one where I went to Washington for the meeting. What year was this?
1985. There was also something in 1974, but I'm not sure what the 74 involvement with the NSF was.
I don't remember what it was. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I've done a lot of things that I don't remember the details of.
Yeah, sure. So is there anything else from your, so I still want to talk about some other things and some of your things you like to do outside of, you know, outside of your career, some of your interests. We've touched on that a little bit, but is there anything in terms of your professional service we haven't talked about that you wanted to mention?
Yeah, the mistakes I made and the bad things. And I really think it's important to talk about the bad things. I guess I'll confess my personal ones first. I had a consulting job. I really screwed up. I used the wrong basic, it was an enthalpy calculation. And my H0 term was wrong, and I had to redo the whole thing when it was caught. It was very embarrassing that I made such a stupid mistake. That can happen to anybody. This was a stage late in my consulting years. But the other one, personal confession, is really, I really feel badly about. And that was in a management capability. I was on a particular management project, and I had an instrument engineer. And he hadn't done what he should do. And I chewed him out in front of the whole instrument group. And he called me down on it, said, Patsy, and told me that, you know, I should have done it privately. And he was correct. I should have criticized him privately. And yeah, so, you know, everybody makes mistakes. And that's why I call them the black aspects. And that happens. I learned to be careful in my personal interactions. And I really still feel I want to apologize again and again to him for what happened that day. Okay, the other thing is far more serious. And that was professional plagiarism. And I alluded a little bit to that earlier. I first ran into it when we were doing the work on gas hydrates when I was working with Ricky in the early 60s, mid 60s, and ran into the fact that a very prominent name had gone to this Illinois waterworks where this man was working, who had figured out the hydrate lattice. And he returned to his university and appointed one of his graduate students to duplicate the work and attempted to publish it and steal the man's work. Mm. And you shouldn't have it happen at the level at which, and he was a top, at the very highest of our profession. And then when I personally did some work, two different times I had people attempt to steal my work. And the first was with the quantum gas facilities. And again, it was a very prominent person that did it, and it was very, very, it's personally, you know, why do you have to take credit for what I did? And why do you have to pretend you did? That made me feel bad. And the other time was when I attended the meeting in Munich, and it just happened that first, I've been to very many meetings with him, you know, considered him a personal friend and everything, and he proceeded to go up. He did not know that I was sitting in the audience, and of course you wouldn't expect me to be in the audience. And I consider my personal discovery that afternoon with Gary Pope of figuring out how the Burnett experiment could be connected and to lead to the third burial of accuracy. I think that was a tremendously important contribution. And he gave a paper and cited that Mr. Burnett had found this back in New Hampshire back in the olden days when he had done his experiment, and he covered that very point with one sentence in one of his papers that he published in the Proceedings of the New Hampshire Society of something or other, a very obscure publication which I had never heard of until that moment. And he did the entire thing without giving any acknowledgement to the work that we had done at Rice University. When he finished his presentation, I stood up, introduced myself, and called him by his first name and told him that he had admitted that information. I'm it just appalls me that people will try to take credit for what others have done or try to ignore giving credit where it's needed.
So it wasn't just a misstatement or an error, it was intentional.
No, he knew what he was talking about.
So that troubles you?
That troubles me greatly. The other two people trouble me even more because they were, like I say, recognized at the very top level of our profession.
So here's prominent people,
the
well established.
The man who tried to steal my work on the quantum gas is, I'm talking about people who are heads of the departments of major engineering and chemical, chemical engineering departments at major universities in the United States. I'm not talking about somebody that's down in Podunk Junction University. I'm talking about big names. And it really hurts me that these people did this.
Hurts you in what way? Is this diluting the profession or hurt you
personally? I think it's diluting the profession. It's unethical behavior. It's like mistreating a child. People should be more honest.
Do you think being a woman played any role in that?
No. Don't forget the first instance didn't involve me at all. It was somebody else.
Mm.
The last two happened to be because I was a woman that they tried to do it. No. They just wanted to try to take credit for something that I had done as part of the team there at Rice.
I'm curious if you've heard of this new sort of artificial intelligence, ChatGPT.
Yes, I have.
You know, that it's now writing papers and essays and...
So, allegedly, yes.
Well, but it's trained on knowledge that's out there, right?
Yeah.
So there is a lot of talk going on about increasing plagiarism. And
yes,
concern
yes.
that these...
Yes, and
tools.
I have talked to my daughter extensively about this. With respect to her students and the work that they're doing there at the university, even at the community college level.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's something that is a real problem. But no matter what you do and with your artificial intelligence to get an original idea out of something, it's very hard to do.
Meaning machines can learn and...
They can only learn what they have put into them and what they have knowledge of.
Right.
But... to write poetry. I mean, you can read it all and you can write... And people have tried... Sherlock Holmes is greatly admired. And there's all of these writers that try to write in the style of Sherlock Holmes. You know... But none of them, that's not Sherlock Holmes, and you know it's not. And I don't think that anything that the machine language, you could give it all the Sherlock Holmes and they can produce something. You say this is written by Sherlock Holmes? Well, it may look like it, but it really isn't. I don't know. I'm glad I don't have to battle with that particular aspect of education.
So you talked previously about your children's careers and what they've gone on to do, and one of your daughters, June, was trained as an engineer, and so I was wondering what your thoughts were when she decided to go into that, and also if you've seen, you know, thinking back on the field from when you started and thinking about what her experience was in school, how did those experiences, do you think, compare? Did you see similarities or differences between when she started and when you had started in the field?
Well, there were a lot more women going into engineering than she did, that was for sure. Of course, she chose to go into, I said I've been involved in a lot of firsts, but she's one of my first because she was my first daughter. And she went into a field of ocean engineering in the first ever, she was a first student at their high school to graduate, and she graduated, and she was the first to study, and she was first in the first undergraduate program. And the new disciplines of engineering, the development, in every case, the first development of them is at the advanced level as a subset of the basic engineering. And she chose to go into ocean engineering. And so I personally told her that she was doing the wrong thing because she should do one of the basic engineerings, but she didn't pay any attention to me, so that was all right. Mm-hmm. She did what she wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, she had a lot of different experiences than I did. And you'd have to, you know, talk to her to get it, her take, what it was. Of course, ocean engineering is completely different. One of her required classes was scuba diving. And the funny thing, did I tell you the story about my her being a student of the wave theory?
The Chapelier wave theory.
Did I tell that online or not? Oh, you don't know what I'm talking about.
The professor.
Yeah.
I can't remember if that was recorded or not.
Well, my daughter studied ocean engineering, and she's taking a course, and the professor calls the roll and says, "June Chapelier, do you know a Johnny Chapelier?" "Yes, sir, he's my father. I did my thesis work on him, on his wave theory." So, it was funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of the things that happened.
Okay. And then I wonder if you could share a little bit more about, in your retirement, the things you like to do. I know you mentioned earlier the game of bridge. Do you still play bridge? What kinds of things do you like to do?
No, I don't play bridge anymore.
Okay.
John and I, we played bridge. In fact, well, that's first when we got married. There a picture of us before the big bridge tournament, because to publicize it, you know, the young bridge couple and everything. And it became obvious very quickly that it would be better for our marriage if we did not play bridge together. And so, and it took, to be a really good professional bridge player, you have to work very hard at it, and you have to play several times a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I was never willing to put that kind of time into it. And when John married me, you know, he got the ultimate prize, so he didn't need to play bridge anymore. He continued to play throughout his life. Some at Shell at noontime they would have games, and occasionally they would have a Shell tournament, and we might play together in those. But we really stopped our professional playing at that time.
Mm-hmm.
When I retired, I liked the game, and we played casually with friends on occasion. But John was so much in advance of everybody else. Still, they enjoyed playing with him, and we would swap around who played with him and everything. But we didn't do it on a regular, you know, meeting every week type thing.
Mm.
But when we retired, I decided that bridge was a good intellectual opportunity, and that older people, like I'm now a member of the older generations, need some things to do. And I think I need to teach people how to play bridge that don't know how. And so I took bridge, and I can give you a copy of it. I have two sheets of paper printed front and back. And you actually cut them in two so that you, well, I have front and two, there's, I print them front, two sheets, I print them front to back, cut them through the middle, so you have two half sheets of paper printed front and back. That is the entire textbook on how to play bridge.
Hmm.
And it's a matrix organization of basic Gorn point count, and it's a very holy, H-O-L-Y, system, because it's based on the Holy Trinity. Because there are one in three, there are 13 cards in each suit. And I have taught people who have never played cards before to play bridge with this. And there are four suits, and there are four acts, four gospels. And then I go on and use this as a works for a lot of people who have the Christian, know about the the Trinity and all. It's all a matter of having triggers, and if a lot of the vote and the numbers are grouped in groups of three, and I use that through. So there's this matrix like this that tells you how to bid. And then, of course, there's little stars on it. Watch out for these special conditions, and that's on the back side. Then the other piece of paper has an opening lead table that is for Mr. Gorin's work. If you've got this particular holding and you're leading against a contract or leading against an open up, this is the card that you lead. Well, you don't have any other information to go by. It's pretty good to have. And the other one tells you how to score. And those are the essentials to learning bridge. And I started this at that time. We were living in our home in Houston, and we're west the church there. And I started a group, and we met every week to play bridge. And I would have people come in, and they would, you know, learn to play bridge. And they learned. They weren't good bridge players. No, but they could sit down and enjoy the game. And I think it's really essential to be able to enjoy the game. And all. And I had a lot of fun with that. When we later moved, our church member moved to the high rise and moved to the different church, I again started a program there and did it for a number of years. So I actually taught bridge for, I did it as long as we were there, 10, maybe 30 years that I used that. And I've passed my cards on to many people to, if they want to do it someplace else. It's sort of fun to have done that. And then I took up, I started genealogy, and that became a major endeavor for me. I spent many, many hours over the last 40 years or so, more at the beginning. I went in, first of all, I went out to Provo and took a course from the Mormons, and went back 2 weeks later and took an advanced course on Irish genealogy. And I had fantastic, when I went out the second time, I guess it was, my cousin, or maybe it was one, then I went out later and did a week's research in one of these later times. My very good friend's husband, all that he knew about his grandparents were that they had been Christian Science and had married in St. Louis, Missouri. And he wanted me to see if I could get a copy of their marriage license. And so sure enough, I was able to look up and get a copy of the marriage license. And I also looked up the name of the woman, you know, the female name that he was interested in there, over in the family history section, and found in the family history section there the name of this female name, surname that he was looking for, and the name of the person, and it said that they had married and hadn't had any children. But they had children, his father, or his mother, that was it. His mother had whatever the male-female relationship, I'm confusing it. But that, so I found it. So that was a major ring the cowbell discovery. That same week, on Friday night, I went over to the family history section after looking up all those things I told you I wanted to look up. And I started reading, and there were some Stallings. Turns out there were a bunch of Stallings who became Mormons, so a lot of them wrote the story. And then I found Stallings Family Records, this gigantic book, and made my first contact, found out somebody in that who lived just a few blocks from me in Houston actually had a copy of the book, and I tried very hard to buy a copy, but was never able to, so I finally borrowed her copy, made a copy of it, and then did a very extensive directory of that. So that was my, and then I kept on doing research in that. And then I did, I started doing, what else did I do? I started doing private consulting, did a little bit of it, not an awful lot. And I had 9 grandchildren. And having the 9 grandchildren took a lot of time. And it was, it's very complicated. The first one was born was when I was still working for Hudson. My mother-in-law was living with us. And I was had one of these meetings on the editorial review board in San Antonio, and we came home the next day, and we pulled into the driveway, and she came rushing out the door down the hall, down the driveway. Patsy, Patsy, you're a grandmother, you're a grandmother. And so I rushed up to the hospital, of course, to see. This was the first grandchild on both sides of the family. And outside, staring through the nursery window with these looks of utter amazement on their face, like nothing had ever happened like this before in life, were these all of these men, my son-in-law, my husband, my son, my son-in-law's brothers, and his father. There were about eight of them, and they were all just looking at this baby. And that's how you should greet the birth of a baby. It was something. But we, having the kids in different times, one time one of them was born, and my boy was supposed to come to my house, and my friend was having surgery and was very ill, and I remember that one. And then probably the most difficult, well, and then when one of them had their children, and one was in Florida and one was in New Jersey, and I had to go for those. And but then my other daughter decided to adopt, because she couldn't have children. And so they adopted from Romania. And I went both times to Romania to help with the adoption. And adoption is the most difficult way to have children or to have grandchildren, because you never know exactly what's going to happen. And it was really interesting to go and to get them. And they got the first time we went was in December, and we adopted two little girls that were not quite 4 years old. And the following May, my son-in-law and I returned to Romania and were able to adopt twin boys that were not quite 1 year old. And those have been a real joy to everybody.
Well, 9 grandchildren, that's quite a feat. I'm curious, are any of them in STEM fields as they've grown up?
My oldest grandson went to Rice and majored in mathematics and computer science, whichever one came first, I'm not sure, got his master's in computer science there, and is now working in Boston for, what's the big name in computing that's there? Google? Not Google. Fail. Well, I'm sorry, I'll have to put that one in. But at any rate, he's working for one of the number one computing companies. They have a fantastic program there. He's just now a new father, and he's on paternity leave for like 3 months to help take care of the. He has 4 children now. Let's see. Jason is just finished his. He went into medicine. A lot of them in the medical field. He is an anesthesiology associate. His younger brother is still seeking closure. I don't know where he's going to do it, but he also does computing. And let's see then. My engineer daughter, her son, is... he's in computing. He wanted to go into education and didn't end up successful at the secondary level, so he's at the university level, and he teaches computer security at the Houston Community College. So he's in STEM. His sister went into marine transportation, movement of goods and stuff. This is a very special field where they pack stuff and ship it here and there and all this kind of, I don't really understand it, but apparently very, very important to me all. And that's what she does. The twins, the oldest girl, they all had learning problems due to malnutrition and stuff. But the oldest girl went into the Navy first when she got out, and she had health problems, and she finally got out, and she went to one of the commercial things and got a so-called engineering degree and tried it for a while, but then got laid off and didn't like it and went back and got her, she is a certified medical technician, which is a technical field, and so she got her a regular bachelor's degree from University of Houston, and that's what she works at. And her sister became certified in teaching and curriculum planning, and she is on the faculty of one of the high schools here. The two brothers, the one of the boys, one of the boys is a went into police work and trained at the junior college that's in Texas City. Had a very difficult time getting there because he had a lot of those boys had fetal alcohol syndrome problems. So they had problems learning math. And so, but at any rate, he did complete it. And he is a guard, but now he's doing, with the UTMB Medical Center, but instead of doing the guard duty, he is the dispatcher. He has progressed to that stage. And he's doing quite so. His brother is not does not have any profession. So, yeah, I've got some STEM activity still. You never know what's going to happen. But for the next generation, though, I've got, what do I have now? I have 8 or 9. How many is it? Great-grandchildren. So they're all young, interesting melange of things, different kinds of problems and different kinds of things that happen. The oldest girl has Stargardt's disease, which is her eyesight. And she is, it basically means that she's going blind. Mm. But I have every confidence that in her lifetime we are going to develop the ability to transplant eyes and that she will be able to have eyes and be able to see. That's why I have a lot of confidence that we're, our STEM activities, and that covers everything, can make our life here on planet Earth. And that's why it was me, it was so important that we land on the moon, because that was showing we can get there, we can do things. And I have confidence that someday she's going to be able to see.
Well, I think that's a really good segue. I was wondering what innovations in the future you hope to see, or what hopes you have for the future of chemical engineering or engineering or the sciences more broadly.
Where I would really hope that we could make advances in is different from where I expect we'll make advances. What I really would hope is that we could learn how to live with each other and respect each other. And that's the soft sciences, psychology and sociology. Where we will have advances, I think we're going to have advances in our energy field tremendously. I think we're going to have, we've seen in our, even in the last 6 months, 3 months, 1 year, whatever tiny period of time, tremendous advances in the medical field. I think those will continue. And that, of course, is all who makes the medicines? Chemical engineers. Mm-hmm. That's the chemical engineering. We may discover new, in fact, we will, because in my lifetime, pressure swing absorption didn't exist when I started. Cryogenic processing did not exist. Those were the developments in my, so yes, there will be new processing of unknown whatevers that will happen. We barely know now about extremely high pressure and extremely low pressure operations, and there's going to be a lot of work there. I was privileged to work with Bob Curl, who won with Smalley the Nobel Prize for development of nanotechnology, discovery of the nano. And I think I told you the story of how he spoke to the alumni, and I got to hold the Nobel Prize in my hand, and I actually held a Nobel Prize in my hand. I mean, that and speaking at the Marie Curie were probably the top thrill times of my experiences. So yes, I think there's going to be more and more knowledge at the extreme conditions of operation, and that's the real challenge, to be able to do things subsea. We hardly ever utilize the ocean. Of course, right now we've got all of that place where all the plastics is accumulating. I mean, that's some of the bad stuff. Well, all right, we're going to solve the problem. Nuclear waste, we're going to solve that problem. That doesn't bother me in the least, that we're going to solve those problems. But if we need to solve problems, the first is man killing man. I'm very interested in so-called mission activities, and I have participated in, over the years, in several different what we call mission trips in my church activities, where you go to an area where maybe there's been a natural disaster and you're helping build things back. One of them I went to was an Indian school thing in our western United States where we're trying to help some of the Indian things and doing things at that school. But recently, here in the last 10 to 15 years, I helped start a program in our church that we call Sowing Seeds of Love. And we started off, the reason we started was somebody or other found out, and the preacher asked this woman who doesn't know how to sew to head the project, and she organized it and got it going, and I was one of the first sewers. And we made bags to hold Bibles, and we went around and asked people for money for Bibles. There was an African nation that was run out of their homeland, and they went into South Africa, and they were living on the stairs of the bishop's residence in near Johannesburg, this whole village of people. And the kids didn't have, you know, their teachers, if they had nothing. So we sent them these bags and the money to buy the Bibles, and that became their school books. And that was how it started. And when I'd been at the other church before we came here, there was a woman who had, Jesse Casey, and she had started a program many years ago when she had gone to one of the charity hospitals in Houston and had seen all the little kids with nothing to do and nothing to play with, and she started a program of making little stuffed animals and made hundreds of thousands over the years of her life. She headed a program at that church. So we decided to start a program like that here at this church, and got materials donated for the materials, and we buy the stuffing and buy ribbons and buy paint, and we make little animals about the size of your hand, and then those go out on medical mission trips where we have a lot of different doctors participating in that. They get Doctors Without Borders and things, and so they have something to give the kids to calm them down when they're trying to, and they use them that way. So they use that way, and then they're used locally on the fire trucks in this area. They have them in Galveston, and they go to the fire and they give the little kid the animal and it calms them down, and they're used in battered women's shelters where the children come in and have no toys, so they get something. And my program that I've participated in for the SAPS and have headed now for the last few years, we were making over 1,000 a year, and COVID slowed us down, but we're now back in production. And anytime they went with a group from a community, a college group went on a mission trip to Mexico, a group from a local Lutheran church went, that I happened to talk to somebody at my beauty shop and found out about it. So they took some animals on that trip. My grandson went on a medical group many years ago down to Haiti and took some there. Another woman I knew went with her church to India and took some to an orphanage there. And they've been many, many places in Africa. One lady went to China on a young woman, and she used it to promote goodwill among the young Chinese people, not children, but older. So that it's trying to promote goodwill, and I hope it's a good program. And we meet every week and work on it. So that's taking a lot of my time now. But anyway, I can't think of anything else. That's, you do.
Well, so looking back on your career, your life, I know you've highlighted some of the things you're proud of already in the interview, but is there anything else you wanted to share in terms of your reflections of what you're most proud of or what you feel you've contributed throughout?
Well, like anybody who has progeny, I do know that I have something that will go on through that. For people who do not have children, you do not have that. I'm very fortunate to have that. I think that the discoveries in the field of chemical engineering that I participated in, well, I know from what I told you about names. I'm sorry, Gibson. Your first name is not Gibson.
Gail.
That's
okay.
Said she studied what I helped discover. So I know that that is going to go on. And I hope that my wishes for the future will happen. But I think I've tried to make a mark. Although I think I've left something. Will it be remembered 100 years from now? Probably not. Because it will be, everybody knows that. So, and you don't think, there's so many things that, I mean, I use the microwave. I have no idea who developed the microwave. And I take it for granted. I vaguely know, I get on the airplane and it has all sorts of advantages. And I know that the Wright brothers were the first ones. 100 years from now, I don't know whether anybody will remember the name of the Wright brothers. Mm-hmm. But yet they will take advantage of flying. And we get in our automobiles and drive, and we don't remember who were the ones that invented automatic steering. And that's tremendously important. Makes it a lot easier to drive a car, right? But, so no, people aren't going to remember you many years from now, but maybe what you did will live on. Like the first guy that invented fire, well, we don't know who was, but we still use fire.
Did you have anything else, Gail, you wanted to ask? Okay.
Well, I certainly enjoyed talking to you and telling you, and I hope I've gotten a little bit of my philosophy across too. But the most important thing in engineering is to remember safety first. Safety is the most important part.
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate all the time you spent with us and sharing your story and experiences. And is there anything else you wanted to mention that we didn't cover?
I can't think of anything.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Okay. Glad you did it.